Getting Through Winter on episode 406 of the Actual Astronomy Podcast. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane, back from the brink, and we are amateur astronomers who love looking up the night sky, and this podcast is for everybody else who likes going under the stars. We have a Patreon supporter to thank, Shane.
Yeah, thank you, Stanley. Appreciate the support, and we appreciate all of the Patreon supporters. It helps us out a lot, so thank you.
Yeah, no, really nice. Thank you so much for that, Stanley. I didn't get a chance to drop a note back, but I will, unless you've had the opportunity, Shane, but you've been a little bit under the weather, so I'm thinking that didn't happen on your end either.
Yeah, I haven't really been touching email or anything. And even on a good day, I'm not really touching email a lot. So
yeah.
I have not gotten around to it.
It's all good. It's all good. You're feeling a little bit better this morning by the sounds of things?
Yeah, a little more energy. Still not out of the woods, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, good stuff. Just playing around with my volume here a little bit, trying to get things going. So I almost shouldn't even ask, did you get observing this week?
No, I was tempted, but whatever is ailing me kind of hit me Thursday. And I think that's when the clear nights started to pop up, or Friday night was clear anyway, but a little windy. However, I just didn't have the energy to go out. How about yourself?
Yeah. No, it was, I looked out that night and I was like, yeah, I started this new job back in the winter and I was making numbers up. I shouldn't say that. I wasn't really making numbers up. I was just doing some numerical analysis. And by the end of that, and yeah, went out with coworkers after work. It was fun. And then came home and then, yeah, clear. But it was like, I mean, it was windy. It was like 36 kilometers an hour or something. So I was like, yeah. And see, like when I have to drive out to the observatory, you know, Ken, the road can be not great if there is wind like that, even though it would probably have been fine in the observatory, but it might not have been amazing. So I was just like, man, and I'm kind of working on some other things for astronomy. So, and that's fine. Like I have different astronomy interests. Some people have different hobbies. Like I know you have different hobbies. I just have different sub hobbies in astronomy.
Yeah, that's fair.
So I've been doing some more sketching and sketching to say the least. So trying to sketch not every day, but most days I'm sitting at the table and working through the sketching process. And one thing, Bill, he's been on the show before, he's a long-term friend. And he was asking if I was doing the sketches under like low light or red light or amber light or anything to kind of emulate the conditions. The answer is no. I did try that. I'll get into that in a sec. And Royce, who's a listener, he sent in some amazing sketches, and we've been kind of going back and forth about those. So he does this amazing technique of using dots and lines. I'm not sure if you've seen those, because I can't recall if he sent the first image or so to theactualastronomy@gmail.com or whether it was after he and I just started going back and forth. But it's really cool, like using almost like a cross thatching technique, I believe it's called. So he was making some recommendations on learning that technique. So that's really cool, because I don't have any kind of drawing or art background. And so I really appreciate when people do write in with that kind of guidance. I think Ken also wrote me with some guidance. I got to get back to him probably later on this afternoon as well. And one of the things, it was kind of wild, because Royce recommended getting a pencil holder. And this seems so non-astronomical, but I'll explain why a pencil holder is key to doing my astronomy, Shane.
Okay.
And that's that I was having a little trouble juggling like pencils and the little brushes that we use for the Mellish technique. When we're sketching, what we do is we make like a bit of a powder, and we use that for the nebulous portions. And you know, when you have like your brushes and your pencils and your pens, and it's nice to have a few pencils, because of course they dull out, and then it's virtually impossible to sharpen a pencil in the dark, or at least I haven't found a good technique yet. So I usually keep like three or four pencils, but then you're just kind of juggling them around. So I saw where there was one observer, I think it was Jeremy Perez or somebody, had made a video, and he was using these pencil clips on his clipboard, which is cool. So he has like his clipboard and his drawing paper on the clipboard and a gooseneck light, little like lamp to do his sketching by. So I've kind of copied that, but I don't use a sketchboard. I use just a nice sketching book, which is hardcover, so I can kind of dispense with the sketching board. But when I try to put the pencils on that, of course, if I want to flip the pages or whatever, suddenly you've now got a whole world of mess. So what Royce recommended was these neat little pencil holders. They're kind of just like a little board with almost looks like little pieces of like coat hanger or wire or something. And then your pencils and different things that you want to have there can be kind of just sort of hooked into this. And I love that idea because I can just bring this with me and then just drop it wherever I am. Or I only bought one, but I was thinking afterwards I should have bought more, but maybe my builder can build me some of them. He's pretty good like that. Or maybe I can even build them and put a couple in the observatory and a couple down below and have one here. Would be really nice. So yeah, it's kind of neat to be learning from other observers and people who are much better at sketching and art than I ever will be. So it's really fun. Yeah. Yeah. It's cool. I really, really like that. On a similar thread, I was exchanging emails with listeners. Thank you have as well, Shane, on how to stay motivated during bad weather and busy times with work and that sort of thing. And, you know, even just off the top of your head, any sort of ideas and recommendations on what you do to stay motivated in the art or the sport of astronomy, so to speak. Yeah.
You know, usually it's just planning, you know, like planning for the next session or planning for the next season. I kind of enjoy that, you know, coming up with my lists, start reading some guides about the objects that I may want to look at. And just doing some general research, and often it spirals into something completely different where I'm just enjoying the time, right? And I'm not actually working on a project. Yeah. So that's one thing that I'll do. I probably spend a little more time on cloudy nights, just reading forum posts. There's always, you know, interesting information there. So yeah, I find myself a little bit more or spending a little more time there.
Mm-hmm.
And then just prepping some of the gear. Like if you need to clean an eyepiece or you want to fix a mount or whatever it might be, you know, that's the time to do it. So, just kind of going through the gear and organizing it and making sure it's ready to go when I'm ready to go. So nice. That's kind of it for me. How about yourself?
Well, I'm doing a whole pile of different things and then just working on the calendar to get it out of the way and, you know, just different aspects of that kind of stuff. This one, though, kind of end up being a bit of a blur between a lot of different things that I do. And I'll do some reading and like to read some old paper. So I've been reading like some of Barnard's old works. E.E. Barnard was a late 1800s, early 1900s astronomer who was an amateur astronomer who became a professional astronomer, was an amazing observer and a pioneer, became a pioneer in the realm of astrophotography. Interesting dude. Anyhow, so one of the things that I was doing is I was copying photographs to practice my sketching. And so I'd sent a couple of them off to Randall, who was on the show way back when. I'd like to have him on again sometime once he gets the Dorner Telescope Museum rolling here in the next few months. But anyway, Randall, it's just such a wealth of information. And he sent me an article by H.D. Curtis, who was an astronomer at Lick Observatory just after Barnard. He published this paper in 1918. It was part of like volume 13 of the Lick Observatory Annals or whatever it is, like great big thick old book. But one of the chapters, I guess chapter 3, was the Planetary Nebula. And so I had done this sketch of the helix. I think I shared that with you and Mike and a few of the listeners, even who are listening, are going to be like, oh yeah, Chris sent that sketch. I thought it was one of my better sketches that I've done. So I was kind of like pretty amped on it.
Yeah, it was
so
really
then
good.
Randall sends me this bit by Curtis. And it was really fascinating because during the early times of photography, they were trying to enlarge the images to print them in order to talk about what was seen in the photographs. But because of the, you know, the early skills still being developed, they were only doing that or able to do it for some of the larger planetary nebulae like the Helix or some of these other ones. But really small ones, they weren't. They could see some details in the negatives or the proofs, but the images were really small, like tiny, tiny, tiny. And they weren't at the time able to reproduce the images in a way that people could see in a paper or in a mass distribution book or whatever. So Curtis was sketching these many of these planetary nebulae, and he had done this very large survey of planetary nebulae and had created sort of like an OG list of 78 targets north of negative 34 declination, I think was the number, which makes them all visible from, you know, where we live and where, you know, virtually most people in North America would have access to skies that would reveal these at least at some point during the year. So I thought that was pretty cool to kind of go through that article, read about somebody who had sort of done this more than a century ago. And the article's pretty neat. The objects are not what I would have thought for a list that's just about 100 years old. And it was pretty much a comprehensive list of all of the planetary nebulae that were known kind of sort of at that time. I think there were some known in the Southern Hemisphere and that. But somebody was looking for a neat list. I keep coming up with lists to do that I will never have the time to do, but this one really piques my interest, is to go and you can just take a look for H.D. Curtis, the planetary nebulae, and I even put a list, a link to the list in our show notes there. I don't know if that can get shared out.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really neat. The images in that aren't great, but you can kind of dig around on the internet and eventually find some of them of his sketches, which were well done. But the neat part is that, you know, when you do a sketch like that sitting at the table, often it raises a lot of questions with people like, oh, you know, why is it so pronounced and blah, blah, blah. But he talks about sort of this exaggeration and kind of getting back to Bill's remark of doing the sketch under low light conditions to try to emulate becomes difficult, because when you're working from a sketch or when you're working to sketch something from a photograph, the photograph is much more exaggerated than what you're going to see at the eyepiece. It's meant to be seen under almost like regular ambient light conditions inside of a well-lit room or space or outdoors or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Curtis talks about this a little bit, that when you go and try to do that sketch, you will, like, by nature exaggerate things. And I've noticed this even just sketching in the field, that you will exaggerate things just to have the right gradient, because sometimes the difference between what is the brightest section and what is the dimmest section is often so subtle that if you were to accurately portray that, the whole thing comes off as just looking homogeneous, and it loses, even though maybe you've done it accurately, it loses the effect, right? And so with the sketching that I found anyway, is it's a bit of an illusion that you're creating. You're trying to give an impression of what the target looked like, not necessarily like 100% reproduction of maybe what you were looking at. So anyway, it's kind of neat to kind of be working through that. But I tried to do one under low light conditions, and it just came out really wacky. It looks okay, like if it's really dim, like in dim light, it looks great. It looks perfect in dim light. If I like dim my settings down on my phone almost all the way, or I take a photo of it and kind of blur it, like I did M33, it looks really good, like very impressive. But if I just take a regular shot of it, it's just way too there's way too much like contrast. It's like kind of like your contrast has been turned way up by just the scratchiness of using basically chalk or white charcoal on paper. You know, it's kind of a weird thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's neat to hear you try these different techniques and experiment and, you know, do it kind of indoors just so you can evaluate and see your progression. Cause I think if you were trying to do this at the eyepiece, there's other challenges that are introduced, right? Like as Bill kind of alluded to, you know, you're working under probably a red light, it's dark, you're cold, you know, there's other things.
Oh, yeah.
So then, you know, if you're not happy with the result, there's too many variables there to say, I don't like this technique.
But, yeah,
you know, controlling some of those variables, I think is pretty cool, you know, and it allows you to determine whether or not this is the right approach for you.
Yeah. And it was neat to do the experiment. And just to see, because Bill had sent that to me. I just read the Curtis paper who talked a little bit about this. And then I tried it just to see what would happen. And kind of, it did sort of what I had predicted it would do, which to me was a bit of a win, because even though I didn't end up with sort of as good a sketch, it kind of taught me a few lessons there, like you mentioned. Yeah, it's just kind of neat to work through all these different and varied things inside, and to do some learning where in and where you're comfortable. You can do 5 or 10 minutes or half an hour, and then get up and, you know, drink some water, work on podcast notes. I was gonna say watch TV, but it's not what I typically do. I work on some podcast notes, talk to some listeners via email or whatever, and then kind of go back to it for another 5, 15, 25 minutes or something. Yeah, it's nice. But it was Alex Massey. I'd kind of sort of been tooling around with this a little bit, and then Alex was like, well, and Alex is an amazing astro sketcher, and has videos online that I was using to learn from, and so we'd started communicating. But Alex was saying that, you know, you kind of get to a point, I guess, where most of your learning will come inside. So you have to be inside and working on this stuff, versus trying to do it at the eyepiece. You'll just, you know, go mad trying to learn this stuff at the eyepiece. You'll just waste nights, right? So.
Yeah. I do like Bill's suggestion, though, of once you get more comfortable or confident with the styles to practice indoors under dim light, with a red light or whatever, and, try to simulate that experience at the eyepiece. I think that is a great suggestion once you get to that point.
Yeah, maybe. I just don't know what I would use for the source, because
Yeah, I guess, hey, that's a good point.
that becomes the challenge. It's sort of hard to, till you do, it's kind of hard to get your head around it, but you would almost need to take somebody's sketch to try to work from. It just becomes a bit. And then the other thing is, I mean, to be frank, I think I did, like, I don't know, last between August and, you know, mid-January, I think I did like 250 hours at the IP sketching. So, like, I get a lot of time sort of doing that anyway, and that's fine. And I've kind of got that part of it is fine, and I continue to refine that a little bit. I find it really hard to emulate that inside, because I want to be on my chair, because I kind of have a particular way I like to set up my chair. I was talking to Ken about this. Ken's got the slightly larger version of my chair, and I was just saying how kind of wish I had the slightly taller chair that he has, because it would enable me to have a better ergonomics at times. So I might even get a larger observing chair at some point in time. But I like my observing chair, and I don't have it here. So I'd have to really have my, like, I don't have a lot of that stuff here. And then where I have it is like, well, that's where I observe. It's almost like at a certain point, it just gets almost easier to do it at the eyepiece, because, yeah, you know, eventually we do get the nights, and I could be up there and set up and doing it that way. So I think I'm going to buy some more lights for doing this, and yeah, just continue to work away at it. Spoke with Damien last night. That was fun. Sorry that you weren't able to join us, but we had a nice chat.
Yeah, I'm super disappointed I wasn't able to participate, but I actually was in bed when you guys were
Yeah.
recording and dreaming of I don't know what I was dreaming of. I can't remember, but I was out and trying to
All good.
recover from whatever is cutting me down here. But how did it go? I always love big aperture conversations.
Yeah, I mean, the conversation, I always feel bad because I often have to create like the title and put it in before we do the recording. So I try to make up my notes and try to figure out what the conversation is going to be, and then stick a title to it. Sometimes it doesn't quite work. In this case, it was sort of kind of close. We put in the information that was in the title in the last 10 minutes. Kind of Damien sort of, you know, caught us on that. But, you know, one of the ways that we like to do this show is to make it very much a conversation. And we were just kind of chatting and having a good time, and he's like, we've hardly even talked about the topic. We mostly talked about big telescopes and observing in Australia and all this stuff, and what it's, you know, their club is like, and all these different things, and talked a little bit about the imaging, and then towards the end kind of got into, you know, the meat of it. So it ended up being a slightly longer episode. I think that's my fault for being allowed to freewheel for a show. So that's one of your longer shows, folks. That's what you'd get more of if Shane wasn't here being the clock keeper.
Oh, well, I'm sure it's good content and I'm excited to listen to it. And I liked your text because I really don't listen to our podcast because I record it. And this is one I will listen to. I'm really looking forward to it.
He's got some neat scopes. He's he was talking about, because he's in Australia and it's summer there, the end of summer. And he's like mowing his lawn, listening to our podcast, right? He's telling me about this. And I'm like, yeah, right now we're having like biggest storm, like biggest storm of the season kind of thing. And yeah, it was pretty neat to sort of be comparing that. He was just in from swimming at the pool, like with his kid. So it was like, here we are, like under a big snowstorm. Last thing you're thinking of, I mean, if you could go swimming here, you just have to chainsaw out a hole in the lake, I guess. So so there's that. But that was a lot of fun. And I did offer to come down and mow his lawn when he goes on vacation that
Oh,
week.
smart. I like your style.
Yeah. Sad news, though. I mentioned going for a Foster's at the end, and he said that that's not like as big a thing. I was, what? But then I was like, he's in Newcastle. And I was like, well, Newcastle, I think that's a British ale. Anyway, have
Yeah,
to do
not
some
too sure.
traveling and get all this sorted out.
That's right. With a telescope in
Yeah.
your carry-on.
Yeah. One thing listeners could chime in on. Here's something listeners could chime in on. There's a lot of different topics here, and then we're going to read some emails. But chatting with Marie Noonan. Remember, she came on, we were doing the show out of Kitchener-Waterloo last year in 2023. Anyway, Marie's a lunar observing expert. And so I asked if she wouldn't mind coming on to help with the calendar, because I mean, I think she assumes that I know at least half of what she knows, not even close. And she kind of talks the same language on the moon as Alistair Ling. So I put them in touch, and she's going to help figure out some of the lunar stuff for the RAC Observers calendar. So that's cool. But then the other thing I asked her about, because she's an observer, I'm an observer, we have lots of imagers and scientists and really smart people who work on the calendar. But as a fellow observer, I wanted to have somebody else on that talked my language, so to speak. And so her and I were just like firing some emails back and forth. And so she suggested, I thought this was kind of neat, is a bit of a list. Or see, we have a calendar, and of course you have like your months and your days. And as we know, there's some better times of the year to observe certain things than others, right? And so her idea was we should try to incorporate that into the calendar.
Oh, yeah, I don't mind that.
I thought that was a good idea.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people end up running their planetarium software to see kind of, when I'm observing tonight, what is kind of in the southern horizon at the highest point that, I can get it at. So if the calendar figures that out for you, that's probably beneficial.
I thought that sounded really useful. So we talked about like Messier's at first, like M79, M83, M67, M55, targets like that. And then I was thinking, well, we have lots of space that we could fill up. We can make like a bit of a list. I don't know of how many objects. So then I was like, NGC 6231, which is not visible from here, but it's, visible from like places like Ontario and Eastern Canada. And then there's some other targets. I know there's a globular cluster below Sagittarius. Well, it's right in the very bottom of Sagittarius. It's like, let's say it's like 6721 or 6237, something like that. I can't remember. It's right on the border of Corona Australis and Sagittarius. But there's only like a few weeks or a month out of the year. There's usually like a few weeks that are best out of the year to see this. And so what we're trying to do is typically the calendar focuses on events that are very timely, like the moon and Venus pairing up on a certain night and events of that nature, right? Occultations, eclipses, blah, blah, blah. But then we were like, well, maybe we could put in some of these sort of, sky grazing or grass grazing objects and just kind of see how it helps to fill up the calendar. Because then it doesn't matter if a lot of the times we get a day that's like chock full of events. You get like Uranus at opposition. You got Saturn close to the moon. You have, the some other type of thing, a historical event. And then like the next 3 days, like blank, right? And it's like, well, maybe we can put some deep sky stuff in here. I was trying to figure out a way to do that anyway. And I think her idea was winner. But if listeners out there have ideas for how we can include some targets or some of your favorite low on the horizon targets from Canada or particularly like the northern US, then we'll try to fit those in. It would be nice to have like a nice list of, I don't know, at least a few dozen targets, I think, and we can just drop them in throughout the year. But I mean, could be more, could be less. I don't know. If people want to send me some of their favorites, some of mine are like NGC 253288, pair of galaxy and globular cluster there in Sculptor, I think something like that. Anyway.
Yeah, I like it. I'm
Yeah.
excited to see what this turns into.
Yeah. Bit of a rambling on a variety of different things, but this is what I do. This is how I stay motivated when we're having the weather that we're having right now, which is like a big snowstorm blizzard kind of thing. Eh?
Yeah, it's not nice outside.
No, it's bad out there. It's really bad out there. We had a email from Tim Shane. Did you want to maybe give this one a bit of a
Yeah,
read?
sure.
Okay.
So Tim says, "Hello, Chris and Shane. It's Tim from St. Louis. Well, where to begin with this one? I'm so full of excitement right now that I can barely collect my thoughts for this email. My very first telescope was a Celestron AstroMaster 114 EQ, a 4.5-inch Newtonian on a manual equatorial mount. It wasn't bad, good optically, but it didn't collimate very easily with the plastic mirror housings, and the included mount and tripod weren't the most steady. Though it was a great tool to help me learn the night sky while getting started. My second and current scope is my Orion 8-inch daub, the one with the stickers that Chris thought was a 10-inch a few episodes ago. This is a forever scope. I've made several modifications to it. We take camping. I use it alongside my 15 by 70 binos, and it will provide amazing views to the end of time. But aperture fever has fully set in. I've seen the difference that going from 4.5 inches to 8 inches makes, the brightness, the resolving power, and I need more. Dimmer nebula, more distant galaxies, more stars and globulars. I want to see more. So now I'm getting more. I have just placed an order with Hubble Optics for one of their 20-inch f3.3 sandwich mirrors. Wow, that's awesome. To use in my upcoming telescope build. I've been studying David Craig's and Bar or Richard Berry's The Dobsonian Telescope build manual, playing with Mel Bartel's online calculators, and absorbing every bit of information I can get through my eye holes and ear holes. I've got some designs drawn up, and now I've taken the first real step in attaining my dream scope. The end goal is the beautiful classic obsession style daub in the large 20-inch aperture that they made so popular. But in a very short f3.3 focal ratio for those relatively wider field of views. As stated above, the scope will house one of the Hubble Optics plate glass sandwich mirrors, which I've chosen for their lighter weight and enhanced cooling properties. Now you may say I said plate glass. That's right, I'm not going the traditional Pyrex route. Admittedly, mostly because of cost reasons, but also everything I've read tells me that once the mirror reaches ambient temperature, there really is no difference in observing between Pyrex and plate glass. It is just the acclimatization period that makes the difference. With the sandwich mirror and optimized airflow through the scope with fans, I believe I can get that adjustment time down to reasonable enough levels for me to bring or for me not to notice a big difference. Now, all of this has brought out something new to me. I'm not usually the kind of guy who gives names to inanimate objects. For instance, I have friends who like to name their cars, but I feel like this scope will need a name, and I wanted to share a few of my initial ideas with you and the listeners. The first is a Star Wars video game reference. I'm fond of the character called Starkiller and had toyed with the notion of naming a big daub as such. Second, and a big fan, I'm a big fan of Formula One. I am too. In particular, reigning three-time world champion Max Verstappen. And in a moment of sleepy silliness, I thought up the name Max Verstappature. And I might be sticking with it. I kind of like that. That is actually really good. Lastly, is one that came to me while listening to some of your past episodes. For your telescope naming consideration, in Chris's honor, actual astronomers, I give you the Neb Buster. I look forward to hearing your guys' thoughts on my project, and as always, clear skies from Tim. That's pretty cool. That's exciting that he has like such a fast, big aperture telescope. That is going
Yeah.
to be a lot of fun to use.
And then he wrote me, I don't know if he sent it again. I can't remember sometimes what emails come into the general box and what emails come into me directly. He did receive the mirror. So he
Oh,
ordered
nice.
it and then it just arrived. I guess it was a mirror they found or had on the shelf or somewhere. It's not like really old, but it was a mirror from like just a couple of years back. And maybe they made a whole pile like during the pandemic and had them ready to ship. Because that's always the concern when we're ordering custom gear. And this, like, you're getting into 20-inch telescope mirrors are not typically off-the-shelf things. And so I was kind of blown away that Hubble Optics just like basically winged him one. So between he sent this, we I think had a week, we recorded our objects to observe, so we didn't get back to listener emails. And then by the time we put this one in the notes, he's already had the mirror in hand now for probably a couple of weeks by the time he hears this this email coming out. So they got him a mirror faster than we could put it in the episode recordings. So
That's awesome. Good for him.
yeah, I'm kind of like, maybe, that's a pretty good way to run a company. That sounds pretty good. Yeah, nice work for Hubble to get that out. And they didn't know that we were going to put that in. And then we did a lot on Hubble telescopes with the show with Damien last night down in Newcastle, Australia, because he's got the 16 and the 24. So yeah, and he was talking about months, only months long wait for complete telescopes. So
Wow.
that's not bad.
No, especially for fast, big apertures. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and he's bought two over a handful of years. So anyway, yeah, really neat, really neat. I'm glad that he didn't name it after me. I never want to have anything named after me because, it's like, it sounds okay, like at a certain level, but one day my wife was saying, "Oh, I'd like to have a park named after me." I'm like, "No, you don't." She's like, "No, it'd be great. And kids playing in the front." I'm like, "Yeah, but that's not what gets in the news. It's like, drugs being sold and, the such and such park." And no, you don't want this. Bad things happen in parks eventually. And or then even just like a place, like I was thinking, we have Prince Albert here, and we've had Prince Albert's. And then like the other day there was freezing rain in Prince Albert. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to have freezing rain inside me. Bad enough when it's outside and I can be in my nice warm house, but I don't want any freezing rain inside me, right?
That's fair. I'm with you.
Sean wrote, "Hi guys, just listened to the Aurora Chasing show and really enjoyed it. Aurora in the Okanagan is very rare, and I would like to travel to take some Aurora shots." He should go up to Alaska.
Yeah, it
Because
sounds it's
Sean,
guaranteed.
he's if he's in the Okanagan, you could drive up to see the Aurora somewhere. He asked if we've had a chance to see this this comet. I think this is 62P. I did put it in the notes. I don't know why it's way down the page, but I'm going to shrink it until it fits. There we go. Great shot of the comet. Love it. Really nice. He caught it going by a bunch of galaxies and stars and pretty wicked shot. I think I tried to hunt this comet down, but I was unsuccessful in seeing this one. Thinking probably you haven't been out in dark skies while this one's been in the sky, Shane, maybe.
No, yeah, I haven't even tried, but I really like the green color and sort of a faint tail there that's coming off, and a diffuse nucleus. And then, like you mentioned, kind of the background is quite pretty with some, it's a fairly rich star field with some galaxies there too.
Yeah, he says this was the first shot is a cropped one taken through his AT-72 ED2 on February 13th, and I had time to frame the second one this way because of the number of galaxies in Virgo. This is like the second shot that I put in. So this is the first shot where it's by some stars. And then I thought this second shot was the really, really cool shot going through the galaxy. So that's when I put in. He said, "Is this shot going through the Virgo galaxies is so mind blowing, and then having a comet in there as well, I thought was super neat." I totally agree with that. I think it's a fantastic photo. Sean, send that into our calendar. I think there's something that went out in the RASC. I think you're an RASC member, if I'm not mistaken. Not that I would know, but if you're in Canada and you're an astronomer that's taking photos like this, you might be an RASC member. Yeah, I'd like to have that one. They can consider it. The comet had barely moved in a couple days, as this was right around the time it was stationary in our skies. Also have a few more Pons Brooks images that I'm working on. I had zero interest in comets prior to your show with Don McColes. It was so great you guys were able to have that conversation with him. I've been going back to his earlier podcast episodes to listen to his comet hunting stories. Love listening to your show, Clear Sky Guys. Sean, thanks, Sean. Really appreciate that.
That was nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And that is like one of those things that we were referring to earlier of just sort of listening to podcasts, reading stuff, talking to other observers, and then just sort of cultivating all these other interests and rabbit holes to go down in astronomy.
Yeah, for sure.
It can be too easy just to sit back and peruse gear, but and gear is fine. It's fun, but you know,
it's about using it.
Yeah, some of this other stuff is really cool. I've been chatting with Royce. This is sort of the maybe I'll read it because this is like, and for context, so this is personal communication, but I did check with Royce first, and got an email back from this morning saying it was fine, but we've been talking. So he's, I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe he's a newer observer and definitely not new to illustration and creating sketches, but new to doing this in an astronomy way and at the eyepiece. And it's really fascinating to have somebody who's doing this at the telescope for the first time, but with his experiences and the way that he has gone through, like his process is, I think, like this is a very similar process to what I try to do. And I know how other experienced observers, and like when we've had Howard Banach come on and talk, he references this. But in the email that Royce had sent me, I think it was yesterday or the day before, he really summarized it very beautifully. And I kind of wanted to read that. Maybe we can chat a little bit about that, and then that'll be our show.
Yeah, sounds good.
So this kind of cuts in sort of midway through the email, but we were talking about M76, which is one of the fainter planetary nebulae it's one of the fainter objects in the whole Messier catalog, Shane. I think maybe there's one or two objects that are fainter, but I think this is just about the most difficult one.
Yeah, I would agree. That one's challenging.
Yeah, and he's observing from like a Bortle 7 sky in a large metropolitan area on the West Coast. And so I was just like, well, that's pretty good. He's using a 10-inch scope, but a 10-inch scope is a good size telescope for seeing this, but under a Bortle 7 sky, I think it's a pretty good challenge to try to do a sketch of it. So he goes on to say, and we're going back and forth, but he goes on to say that M76 drawing surprised me too. After initially throwing in my O3 filter, the nebula really just looked like a slightly elongated oval smear. At 50 magnification, I could make out much more. So I zoomed to 150 magnification on my Celestron zoom and spent a good 10 minutes or so just observing. So what he's doing here is explaining that he's thinking that he's found the object. He's playing around the filter with the magnification for, you know, about 10 minutes or so. He goes on to say, eventually I started to make out a bit of variation between the upper and lower parts of the oval dancing in and out of the view. At that point, I figured it was worth trying to sketch it out. As I strained to see the shape within the nebula, I began to also notice additional details surrounding the oval blur. With patience and shifting between direct and averted vision, more and more of that shape would show itself. When I read this paragraph, like this speaks to me because this is such an elegant way of, you know, very clearly articulating, in my opinion, the observing experience. To me, this is how things look. When you go up and put your eye at the eyepiece, you kind of get that general shape. And then as you, you know, get maybe more dark adapted, or maybe the telescope improves, or just as you're looking at things and you get more sensitive to what you're seeing, you begin to see more of those things. Do you find sort of that to be a similar experience that you have at the eyepiece, Shane?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. The more time you spend, the more you just learn to see more, right? And tease out more detail. There's a lot to be said about that.
He goes on to say, I don't think I would have seen M76 at that level of detail if I wasn't taking the time to sketch it. Sections of the nebula would appear in my vision for a bit, then disappear. I'd focus my attention in that area, and if I could observe the same section again, I basically told myself that it was real and not a figment of my imagination, and sketch it down. In that way, I slowly built up the drawing with these fleeting moments of clarity. I can't say I ever actually saw every part that is in the sketch at the same time, but is definitely a faithful representation of all those fleeting moments I saw during the 20 or so minutes of observing. It was particularly rewarding to look up photos of M76 when I got inside, which confirmed what I sketched was fairly accurate. That was a super exciting moment. I've had this same experience, but sometimes it can be, because I feel like in a way, Shane, we're a little bit polluted with our years of doing this, maybe to try to document it out like that. I really like the way he put that.
Yeah. I think you're right about the pollution comment. I like that perspective. And yeah, the way Royce is positioning this is wonderful.
Yeah. And so I'd asked him, and I always feel like sometimes I'm asking a lot of questions, like when people are showing me stuff. So instead, I asked him all these questions. But he said he was happy to answer them. And yeah, that M76 smaller circle drawing. So he had the way that he had done the drawing, it's hard to describe. It's actually on Cloudy Nights, because I had asked him if he was going to post these somewhere, and he did post it up on the Cloudy Nights sketching forum over the past, well, it's going to be over the past 2 or 3 weeks, so people are interested, they can go and hunt this up. But it was really neat, because instead of just like, this is how I'll tell you how I sketch. I go out, try to get my telescope, everything working properly, and then once everything's going, I do the sketch. To me, that made a lot of sense until I saw what Royce did, Shane. And you haven't seen this, but you should go and look. So he puts his 10-inch telescope out. As it's cooling, he does a sketch of what it looks like when you're viewing through a 10-inch telescope that isn't fully cooled.
Okay.
This just kind of blew my mind. And then as he's finding the target through like this gap in the trees, and his notes are talking about finding a target through a gap in the trees through his finder scope, he did another sketch of finding the object through the trees in the finder scope. He did a sketch of what that looks like.
That's amazing. I love it.
And I was just like, the aesthetic to this is just astounding. I said, you should write a book on this, because this is how you observe. I've never seen anybody so clearly like demonstrate this is how you find something and observe. You know, it's one thing to talk about it, or to write it down in an article, which is done frequently enough, but actually to have those sketches and to give that impression, you know. And I just like the idea of sketching the things as they're happening. This is what it looks like when your telescope is still cooling. This is what a double star looks like with the weird diffraction rings around it, all that kind of stuff. Very amazing. Mm-hmm. He goes on to say, I was lucky that my star hopping path went right between the tree branches and that the nebula hadn't rotated out of view just yet. The sight lines are pretty crummy in my backyard, where most of my observing takes place. I'm blocked by redwoods along the north and east up to about 45 degrees, and my house on the other side to about 30 degrees, but it's relatively dark compared to other areas around the house, so I just need to plan a little bit when I'm going after a specific target. My observing before sketching has really varied a lot from night to night. I don't usually plan on sketching anything in particular and wait to see what it looks like in the eyepiece before making that decision. If the object and the composition look great off the bat, I could start sketching immediately. Other times, like in the case of M76, I might be enjoying just observing for a good 10 to 20 minutes before deciding to sketch. Most of the open clusters took around 10 to 15 minutes to sketch. That globular, so he did this sketch of M3. It was brilliant. So good. People should go and look that one up. The globular cluster took 45 minutes, mostly to tap out all those dang dots. So, of course, we know what that's like. I thought about smudging some pencil to give it a certain feel, but it would have been as accurate. It wouldn't have been as accurate as what I was seeing. The moon sketch was probably around 20 minutes. I like to take time after the initial sketching to see if other things resolve in the eyepiece. So it's pretty contemplative and meditative for me to be doing this.
Love it.
Please let me know if you try the cross hatching or any other techniques and how the pencil holder works for you. I'd be curious to hear how it all goes. Clear Skies, Royce.
Thanks, Royce. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, so did I. I just really thought that was such an elegant way of describing that observing experience and about how long it takes. Like, I'm in sort of the same boat time-wise, and I'd like to find out how long people are taking. I've read and know people who have taken months, like winters even, to sketch just like the Orion Nebula or something. But for me, I like to try to get things down in sort of, and I think I was even talking about this with you, Shane, before the exchange with Royce here, about sort of that 15 to 20 minute time period. Because that gives us the opportunity to get quite a few sketches in, try to get five or six sketches done every night. And so I'm sort of in that same time, Sam, but haven't tried the moon yet. I'm going to try some of the practice tutorials that Roy sent me. So probably this afternoon, looking forward to it.
Right on.
Well, with that, anything to add to the show there, Shane, before we conclude?
No, that's it, Chris.
All right. Well, I hope you're feeling better. And to the listeners out there, please subscribe, share the show with other stargazers you know, send us your ideas, observations, questions. And if you have any very far southern sky grazing objects, or maybe if you're in the southern hemisphere like Damien, you can send us the ones that graze your northern skies. And I'll think about putting those in the calendar. All that can be sent to actualastronomy@gmail.com.
Thank you everyone for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com.